My name is Ray McKeever. Good morning. And this is a Bible study on the book of Job. And since it's Advent time, I've chosen to call it, because it could be called about a million other things, the Job of Advent. How's everybody doing today? Pretty good? What's the general mood here in the village?
Last night was great.
A lot going on, it seemed. I was sitting listening to tapes last night of other people's talks on Job and heard all this hoopla going on outside. It sure was tempting to come out and join them. It did. It sounded like summer in the village at night.
It didn't sound like Job.
What?
It didn't sound like Job.
It didn't sound like Job? What do you think Job would sound like?
That was sorrowful.
Sorrowful. What else would Job sound like besides sorrowful?
Angry.
Testy.
Feisty character.
Job.
Questioning. Great. I had no idea where this was going to start, but that felt like a good one. This is my first Bible study I've ever led. I have no idea how to go about it. But I'll tell you, just preparing for it has been real exciting for me. So I'm feeling real excited this morning. I'm not sure how coherent I am, but you think I'm being pretty coherent so far? Yeah, well, maybe we could, let's see. So, I just wanted to, let's see, where should I start here? What I mean by that is I'm not exactly sure where to start and everything, but I have some notes and a lot of enthusiasm. So, we'll just kind of be together for an hour and explore some about the book of Job. A phrase came to me this morning that's one of those kind of old cliches, you know, that you see written on those little posters that kind of give you a shot of hope for the day ahead or something like that. And a lot of times they're kind of poo-pooed, you know, like today's the first day of the rest of your life kind of thing, and that's supposed to give you a hope and think positive and whatnot. But I thought of one of those, and I think in the context of what I've been reading about Job, it took on a new meaning for me, or at least it deepened in its meaning. And the phrase was, life is a mystery to be lived, not a problem to be solved. And I think that for me, for today, kind of sums up some of what I know about the book of Job. That the content of the book of Job, we often think of in terms of dealing with the problem of pain or the problem of suffering. I would suggest instead that that is only a kind of a core around, or a framework around which, within which, something else is going on, and that's just Job kind of entering into the mystery of life, the mystery of existence, and exploring that in the book. If the central part of the book, or the main theme of the book, was to be, you know, well, what's the solution to the problem of pain or suffering, the book would really be for naught, because no solution is really offered. The writer of the book did not accomplish the purpose. However, if we look at it as a deeper entering into the mysteries of existence, then it seems like the purpose of the writer is accomplished. How many people are familiar with the book of Job in at least a minimal sort of way? Like what the... A minimal. Minimal. This is very minimal. This is pretty good, and this is... Like you've read the whole book and maybe been involved in some studies on it and so forth. So Who's minimal? Okay, where do you stand? Two, half, five. Oh, good. Oh, well, we have a nice variety of resources here today.
I would suggest that Ray, maybe you could say this too shall pass.
What too?
This too, T-O-O.
That's my list.
There's situations that we get into, like Job.
This too shall pass. I got you. So you know this place that Job gets into, right? Comes and goes. Well, maybe it's not so much a matter of whether it comes and goes, but how it comes and goes and what we do with it when we're into it. You know, I think a lot of times we want to pass the time in some sort of way, but maybe what the book is telling us is that it's an opportunity to enter into a dialogue with God in another sort of way. Oh, good. Feels like we could take the whole day just introducing the book. That feels kind of nice. I just want to say a couple things before I forget them, because these are just delightful little interchanges that I had this morning about this book. Well, let me just say something about the general structure of the book, okay? The general structure of the book is that there's a man named Job. Now, see, if I was really doing a Bible study, we'd probably read this in the Bible. We should take out our Bibles and read this. Is that right? How should we do that? There's a man named Job, and I think a word that we could use to characterize him are a series of words, but he's blameless, he's upright, he's without sin, he does no evil. And like he's too good to be true in some ways. He's perfect. He's a perfect man in the way that he lives. He's generous. He's almost generous to a fault. He not only lives well, gives to people, but he has sons and daughters who he thinks so well about that he not only prays for God's intercession and forgiveness for wrongs that they do, but for wrongs that they might do in the future. I mean, he's just got all the bases covered, okay? And not only is this this character Job seen this way by himself, but by God, because there's a dialogue that takes place in the prologue in which God describes Job as being of this nature too. So we have a situation of a man who is without blame, without sin. And then we have a situation where this man becomes tested through a kind of a ploy on the part of a person called the Satan. And in the testing, Job loses everything that he has. The contention of the Satan is that Job is only loyal to God and faithful to God because he has everything. So if you take away everything, he'll sort of, you know, show his true colors and curse God or deny God. Well, that happens, and Job not only does not curse God, but he almost thanks God or blesses God, saying, the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, blessed be the name of the Lord. Doesn't even just focus on what's been taken away. States first, you know, the Lord always giveth, so there must be something in this. So he remains faithful to God. Well, then the next incident is, well, that's fine, but, you know, if you go after Job's body, you know, make him suffer bodily so that he feels internal pain, that'll be the crunch, and then he'll certainly deny God. And, of course, that happens, and Job gets boils and sores and is in a great deal of physical suffering. But again, he doesn't deny God. Even his wife, who has obviously been a significant part of, I think, of his life, and the goodness that he is, tied in very, very closely with that, kind of loses a little faith and says, well, you know, just curse God and die. You know, why live this way? But Job kind of hangs on. So then what happens next is some of his friends come to be with him and try to help him out. In other words, what they try to do, I think, is to give him answers to this problem as to why he is suffering. Okay? That's sort of the middle section of the book after the prologue. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work, even though the solutions in themselves make a lot of sense. A lot of times I've heard the friends talk about is kind of put down sort of people who, you know, try to be helpful but aren't really compassionate or aren't really with. I'm not sure that's true. I mean, particularly as I read them, it's like there's some good stuff in that. There's some good sense. There's a good sense of presence. These three men come to visit Job, and they sit with Job for 7 days in silence. I mean, that's a pretty strong sense of presence, I think. And even though each of the counselors, so to speak, has their own particular bag that they're bringing, so it's not totally empathetic, some advice giving, counsel through advice giving, they're still religious men, and I think pretty compassionate men. So whereas there's been a tendency to kind of put them down in the past, I don't think that it's that easy just to say, you know, when we go to comfort suffering, we better not be like these people. So there's seven male characters in this thing. Let's say this is an all-male play and we're dealing with men's issues. There's Job, and then there's God, and then there's a person called Satan. And what I learned about Satan that I was kind of nice for me reading a commentary was that Satan in this instance is not the same as the devil. And there's kind of I'm sure there's a connection somewhere here between, I bought this knowing that sometime in my life or along the road, there would be some connections that would make sense. Well, this is the first real one that I've run into since I've been back, is these seven characters in the book of Job. None of them quite right. I mean, even God in Job is not quite right. How we see God in some ways. I mean, why did God buy into this ploy of the Satan? You know, why did God want to fiddle around with this sort of, you know, making somebody suffer? I mean, because it was God, in a sense, that did it. God gave the Satan permission, but said, yeah, okay, you know, you can act on my behalf and cause this to happen and see what happens. But ha-ha, you know, Job is so blameless and upright that I'm sure he'll succeed. It's like God's almost got this bigger than God sense of pride or something. Anyway, I don't know. There's something about these guys that might be macho, or I mean, macho is kind of a negative term, but I like to connect it with the spiritual water too. In some ways, that there's some truth in all of them. So, you know, you men in the crowd, take heart in that. That even though we're kind of on the hot seat at the moment in a lot of ways, that we can keep at it, okay? Well, are there any questions so far or anything? I mean, is this a good Bible study? Or should we open the Bible? No, I did mention her. I said the main characters.
Oh.
Well, it's like, you know, that have more than two lines or something. I think she just has about two lines, right? Kind of. Oh, I knew there was going to be a bone of contention in there somewhere.
But she asked the final question.
She does?
Yes. Why don't you curse? curse God and die. That's the most, I think, the most important part in it.
You do.
And he didn't.
Why do you think that's the most important part in it? Could I just address the first of all this thing and then your thing? What came to my mind, Linda, when you and Marcia here had the exchange was that in a sense it feels to me like Job eventually does curse God in some way. Maybe curse isn't the right word, but he becomes very feisty, calls God all sorts of things like a wild beast I mean, you just get this feeling of God as this destructive, horrible character when Job is talking about God. Is that the same thing as cursing God? I mean, to go that far, to be that angry and cursing and so forth. And then my thought was, if Job, this is totally quick interpretation, but if Job actually did get to that point of doing that before he could really let go of the fact that his faith was being held together by his rightness and not by God's grace, like no matter what he was, God would still be there. In some sense, if he didn't take the risk to blaspheme or something, if that was true, then maybe this woman's advice was right away. Well, let's just curse God and die. Then you'll find out that God's right there for you. Is that kind of what you meant?
I don't think that... I should argue with you. I don't think that Job ever gave up the idea that whatever God did was okay with him. Through all of this.
You don't think he gave up the idea that whatever God did was okay? So when he says something like, you know, cursed be the day that I was born, oh, that I would have been, it would have been better had I been born dead. I really don't want to be alive.
Still living.
See, and what I'm saying is that in some sense, you almost have to give that up in order for God to really be there for you. Otherwise, God is there only because you say God is there for you. Does that make sense to anybody? I mean, to me, that's the courageousness of the act. And when you said this thing about the woman's wisdom, I made a direct parallel with, you know, women know what men need to do to be liberated. The oppressed always know what the oppressor needs to change. But it was a thought that hadn't occurred to me before. Anyway. But I hear what you're saying.
The only thing that really makes sense to me is the fact that our imperfectness is what leads to our extreme need for God. Otherwise, if we were like God, we would have no need for God. And that's why I think that Job is a little bit unrealistic, because if Job was that perfect, he would have no need for God, because then he would be God himself.
Well, I don't think that he was perfect. It's just that he really loved God. There are people who... I think the people that are the most close to God, who are servants and they're humble and they help people, they're usually the first ones to say, you know, that they're not perfect, and yet they do all these things that you know that they're really, well, that just that they're serving God and that they love Him very much, and yet they seem to be so without fault to your eyes, and yet they. And I just was looking at this one verse of what Elihu says, Elihu. He's telling Job, he says, be careful not to turn to evil. Your suffering was sent to keep you from it. You know, like maybe Job could have, with all his riches and all his glory, could have started turning towards a lot of pride and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that,
That's just that one verse. But the suffering was sent to keep him from, just like Paul's thorn in his flesh, says it was not taken away to keep him from turning to pride.
Yes.
Doesn't it say in the beginning, though, that he was blameless, upright, righteous? I mean, it says.
Well, it depends on how you define those.
Well, yeah, maybe using the term perfect was wrong. What
it could be a wrong
term. The way where I read the fact that that's still true into what you say is that even a person who does good and helps others and knows that they're not perfect and confesses the fact that they're not perfect are still kind of into a righteousness connection or something with God. And I think they're saying there's maybe that's how Job was. I mean, he confessed his sins. He did it right. Prayed for the sins of his children. So he wasn't not aware of the imperfections and so forth. I misled you by using the word perfect. But he was, you couldn't fault him because he did his life ritually correct. Yeah, that's what I learned, that it's important for that to be set up so that you can't use that argument that, well, the reason you're suffering is because you've done something wrong. It's too easy, or it's too simple a solution. That's kind of why the first counselor gets dismissed, because that's his basic approach. Well, I've never known it to be true all my life that there isn't a direct cause and effect kind of thing.
I think it's offensive, especially to Lutherans.
Yes.
I think that you're not a good Christian unless you're walking around in our world.
Does that make sense, Katie, or do you want to say more about what you said? We can talk about it in the tape room later. I just trying to lay out it in the understanding of the Book of Job and what happens, or at least my understanding. Now, I want to address your thing, too.
Well, I was just going to, tying into what Anna was saying about Job being blameless and it being important, because I think one of his friends that come out of the three friends or whatever says, well, you must be so, God must be causing you to suffer because you've done something wrong. So when basically says, why don't you admit it? Own up to your sin. And Job was real adamant saying, I haven't done anything wrong. That's, I think, when he starts getting angry with God. It's just like, look, I haven't done anything wrong. So why are you testing me? Because I haven't done anything to deserve suffering. I have no sin to suffer. Something like that. So
he knows.
Yeah,
that's not
Job
it.
Job knows that he hasn't done anything wrong. Job figured.
But he still leaves room. He's saying, well, show me what it is, and then I'll. There's always the possibility that I might have made a mistake or done something wrong. But it's up to God
to show Job.
Yeah.
And yet God is the very one at the beginning who said he's blameless, he's upright.
But he didn't tell Job that. The part I always get confused about is that Job is in on this beginning. He's just sort of this
pawn or something.
Pawn. Yeah. Right. Boy. Wind him up then.
Right. Anybody else about this?
Well, I'm not very familiar with the story. So I guess I'd like to hear somebody say what Job learned about that, because if Job is blameless and he was suffering all these things, and I think Dan's right, there are people like that whose suffering doesn't make any sense to us. What did Job learn? Right. And what can we learn from that?
That's the worst part
of the whole thing.
What did he learn?
Nothing. No.
That's about it. I mean, just learn that you don't know everything there is to know about God. So just have faith.
Well,
but that's how I would. That's how I. I mean, it's sort of a disappointing.
Well, but that's something, isn't it, to learn that you don't know everything there is to know about God?
Oh, yeah. I guess the problem for me... Did you have something more?
Sure. It's...
I have two
thoughts. One, it's hard for me to imagine a blameless human being, and I guess I'm thinking about even trying to translate it to today, somebody you know that, I mean, I think the concept of righteousness is it's not exclusive of being human, but I have a hard time thinking of it purely, someone being purely righteous. And I guess like in, maybe because I start looking at people get social classes and things like that, how can somebody who has like that much money or that much good, aren't you tied up in some kind of a structure that might be evil in ways that you don't know? And so I'm thinking about that and wondering whether, you know, whether in one context he was very blameless, but in another maybe he had something to learn. And I guess secondly, I'm also thinking about the value of suffering and why do we assume that that's evil or that that's inconsistent with our faithful lives. I mean, or the concept of death. Why I think we put that in a whole negative area. And just the note that I got from Rolf and all the people who heard from him this week, that the thing he said was. And I think about, you know, like with his, all the tragedies kind of around with his father and his mother and Mark's parents. And that is a lot, and I'm not trying to paint Rolf as the Job, but in a sense, you know, here's this guy who is so good, and yet all this is happening. He said, it's really hard, and life is really tough sometimes. And then he concluded by saying, but it's a gift to be able to live it so fully, to be giving these trials that really, in a sense, test you. And he's the one that pointed out that Marty Haugen, that verse in that Marty Haugen song that says, the deaths and sufferings that make your life grow or something, that there is a trade-off there, and I'm not trying to glorify suffering, but I think we don't often think of it enough as incorporating it into what we experience rather than seeing it as something that's imposed on us. And I kind of heard you say that in the beginning of acknowledging the pain and the conflict as an okay thing.
Yes, yes, of entering into it. It seems like the two things that you say are two separate things, just to...
they came ahead.
Right, right. The second seems more kind of personal, how you enter into it, what it means for your growth, or... You know. The first one, I heard an unresolved question about whether Job is blameless or not, connected with kind of societal structures, you know. I'm not sure how to resolve that one, except to say I'm not sure that that's what the book is about or his character is about. It seems like more what the book is trying to invite us into by painting this obviously unreal figure, someone who is blameless and so forth, is into what you're talking about second. How we...
Yet I also want to think that some of those larger questions that are unresolved are pretty connected to the personal too. I guess I want to think that.
Okay. I think they're intimately connected with the personal ones because, at least in the suffering avenue of explaining the book of Job, you know, to explain the genuinity of suffering, it seems like you're talking about coming down to personal tragedies or personal bad things, you know, that are happening. You know, in people's lives, and how do you explain individual acts of suffering? I think that's where some of the tension between that one friend of Job and Job is, you know, the friend is saying, you know, you're suffering because you did something wrong in the past, so let's just
go. Yeah.
And he's saying, no, I don't think I did anything wrong. And that can carry over, you know, to explaining some things, you know, like cancer in somebody's life. And you see the person's a good person, it's like, oh, you know, this person doesn't deserve cancer. And, you know, it's hard for me to conceive of, you know, like Fran Rolf's case to say, well, you know, his father was a pastor and did, you know, serve God and did many good things for many years. And it would be difficult for me to say, well, you know, his father died of a heart attack because of something wrong he did. I mean, God took him away like that. I mean, I don't mind.
Not that easy.
And if you do buy into it, I think it trivializes human beings and human existence. And it goes into the what Dan was talking about us feeling, you know, really crusty about ourselves, you know, vile sinners, you know, getting down on ourselves. And it goes into that, and then I see a loss of self in there, and that happened. I started to ramble.
Well, I have a bias at that Job is really more more about how to enter into suffering than what to say about suffering. Like Job suffers, the fault of the three friends is that they come and they try to tell Job, give these lectures to Job on what suffering is and how it all, what it all means. And we could do that, for instance, with Rolf. But I don't think that's what we want to do with Rolf. You know, we want to hear his experience of it, learn from that. And I think one of the things about Rolf that's incredibly powerful for me is that to know how much suffering he has had, and yet to sit in other situations with this young man and hear how wise he is about life. I mean, he just and how. It seems like truths and observations come spilling out of him and to connect somehow the fact that I feel like he does enter into this suffering. I mean, sometimes I have to admit it's like I don't want him to bring it up anymore. I don't want it to happen to him anymore because he's so willing to enter into it and talk about it. And yet there's this whole other part of him that attends to life in another fashion.
I want to think that he also has to work at feeling it. And I guess, and maybe I say that just for myself more than, you know, him, because I don't want to keep it all. I think we're pretty good at burying or, you know, at being pretty strong and getting through stuff without feeling it. And that's, again, maybe, to me, would be a potential lesson of the jokes.
Yes.
One of the things that I read, this is to respond to your earlier point, Jeff, the last thing that you said there was that I found interesting was, I don't even remember because I was listening to several people talk about these things, who it was, but they talked about how the names for God that are used in the Hebrew, the old, you know, the old writing, were pre-exilic. Is that the correct term? Pre-exilic names, or before the Moses and whatever the exile. They weren't like when Moses brought the people out of the promised land. That I just have to trust that this is right. But that was said, and if I'm wrong, Dan, you can tell me, or others can tell me. But that was when Yahweh gave the name. That's when God gave him the name Yahweh, revealed. Yahweh. Is that correct? Is that when that happened? And that the names for God that are used in the Job thing are not Yahweh, but names that were used for God before Yahweh. Which takes this story, it reminds me, it takes this story, it's not in our Christian tradition. It's not God as the Christ, as the incarnate God in Christ. It's not God as the, you know, who we understand in a certain way, and like you talked about the God of redemption, and this and that. And it's also not the God of the liberation or the bringing out of the people of Israel. It's not that God, not that name of God or all the things that are connected with that, but it's an even earlier sense of God and maybe a more primitive or, what's another word? Something that it takes us back, and I just wonder how that relates to how we discuss what the meaning of everything that's happening here is. You know, this is not the God who has worked a certain way in Jesus. This is not the God who has worked a certain way with the chosen people. This is another
part of God that works a different way, and what can we learn by that? I don't know. To me, it takes me back to, it takes me to other questions. Judy and I have this wonderful book that we haven't looked at for a long time, but when we came up, we said, oh, we're going to do something on this book. You know, it's called Existential Psychotherapy. And what it's basically talking about is how you look at the problems of life, right? Huh? No, don't be afraid, because it's really what this is about, I think, in some sense. How you look at the problems of life, and there's a certain way of looking at them, you know. Something happens, we form a certain kind of defense mechanism to cope with it, and then we deal with, you know, going to therapy, or we relate our problems to something else, and we deal on that level. Well, what this book is saying is that, I mean, you could talk much better about this than I can, but some of the defenses that we deal with, like, oh, our anger, or our, what are other defenses that we, just name? What? Perfectionism, compulsion, things like that. Things that we kind of deal with on that level as a way of looking into our problems and solving them to do it. But another way to do it is to go onto a whole other level and start looking at things like death, meaninglessness, isolation, freedom, and things connected with that, like responsibility and will. To look on that level as a way to understand our existence. And what the book postulates, I think, is that we avoid these things like the plague. And yet I think that in some sense this is what was happening in Job. Is like they're just, you can deal with the defenses, you can deal with it on a certain level, but there's a whole other level too that you can go to. And I think one by one these, the easy answers or the things that make sense are dismissed. And basically what seems to happen in Job to me is that the success of the book is that Job, or the real thing, is that all of a sudden there comes to a place where God has to talk to Job. Job somehow comes to a place where there's a direct conversation between Job and God. And mostly Job listens and hears again in some way. I just hear that. I hear that a lot around here, or at least hanging out with certain people. It's like, how do we meet God, or how do we know God? And of course, we all know God in certain ways, but I think there's always another level at which we feel empty or something. And to me, that's kind of what Job is dealing with. In some sort of wisdom way, or saying, hey, you know, here's another way to enter into God. I mean, the Bible is not just, it seems like the Bible is, somebody said this in one of the tapes, the Bible is not just a story about God told over and over and over and again the same way. It's a lot of different stories about how God works, who God is, what people's experience of God are. And this is one experience of God that invites us into life in a different fashion. Does that make sense? Have you all been throwing to me? No, you haven't. Dealing with meaninglessness. So, Judy.
I don't know if this makes me think of a story that I read a long time ago, and I have no idea what conclusion I'm going to draw when I start to relate it, but there was a true story written by some people in the United States. I think they were writers, both of them. They had a son who was born hemophiliac, a bleeder, and they had to struggle in finding ways to make sure that he stayed alive. And a lot of descriptions about how to get blood and what to do in a case of emergency and so on. And they also went through a lot of questioning about why would this happen to them, why would it happen to their son. What have they done wrong? How can they control this? You know, here's this innocent baby and has been born like this. What's wrong with the world, with life, that it should happen? And then they took a trip to the Soviet Union because they had discovered that the Soviet Union had set up a different kind of system to deal with hemophiliacs. And I guess some of the czars had been hemophiliac. And so they went there,
And what they were confronted with was an entirely different way to see that situation. And what they said was that the people had a sense of struggle about life and yet could dance and have celebration, but there was always a feeling of struggle. And that somehow out of that, and I wish I could say more about that because that seems what's important, they came out with a sense of hope and willingness to live out of that hemophiliac life that they were in. But they had to have a change of life perception.
College, yeah, a sense of it kind of came out of the revolution and the war history of the country, their suffering and their feelings, and it made them a sense of being together. Mm-hmm. I think of the struggle together, how life takes the interdependence and interrelationships to live the joy. That's where the joy comes from. It's the people that you're living with. Above and beyond the situation that's going on. Mm-hmm.
And a going onness of the thousands of
people. Yeah, that it just
before and after.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Even when you look at a story like that, though, that still doesn't answer the question why, that maybe helps you know how to deal with it a little bit easier.
But I think they didn't say the question why. That's that they didn't have that question. The Russian.
Oh, the Russians.
I think that.
So that was the basic difference, was they weren't asking why. They were just coping with it, basically.
I mean, I don't know. I wish I could say.
You know what? I thought of it on a very literal level, because I think I remember some vaguely in my learning about Russia and the schools and their line of rulership or whatever, that they had a lot of hemophilia in it. Do you remember that? That there was a lot of it going on in the family. And that's... And the connection that I made there was, well, if it's around you and you're dealing with it all the time, you're not separate from it and asking the question, well, why is this happening? You're involved in it. It's kind of like suffering, you know. And I'm just, you know. To me, it has to do with where you are in relation. So if they've got it throughout their history, of course they're going to not be asking why so much with it. Is somehow it's just living with it.
Has anybody read the book Why Bad Things Happen to Good People? Mm-hmm. I heard it. He's a Jewish rabbi whose son died at 14. I forget the disease, but it, all through his childhood, the disease was advanced aging. It aged faster than other people, mm-hmm. and died at the age of 14 as an old man, basically. But he one of his main themes is that the question why is just that you're beating your head against the wall. Just can't answer that at least for him and his experiences in his parish, I guess, in his congregation, Jewish congregation, was to rather than ask why, was just knows that there are powers to tap that God would give to him if he wants them to deal with the situation, rather than to ask the question why and then force an answer out, like, oh, I did something wrong, or whatever, like what Dan was talking about, and say, well, I must, same with Job, I must have done something bad. Just say, okay, we got this situation, let's go with the positive powers that God gives, the power of healing, of peace, and deal with the situation and live with it. Mm-hmm. In life, rather than be bitter about it or something. It's a very hopeful book for people who are dealing with tragic situations.
Susan?
It blows away a lot of the traditional explanations of why, or perhaps the existence of suffering. In fact, it just kind of systematically explains each one and then says, discards it, mm-hmm. and then gives his own idea of what it is to deal with suffering.
Did you want to say something?
Other than when I was responding before about God doesn't really give an answer to Job's question. He doesn't come out with an answer. At least he never comes out with an answer. From my understanding, my experience with the book, Job doesn't come with an answer to the question why. But what happens is that God answers Job. And God speaks to Job, which had not been a part of Job's experience throughout the whole process. And that's, I don't know that we ever really stop asking why. Sometimes I hope we don't stop asking why. For the question of suffering. Because that's when we begin to work at some responses to some of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that God is present with Job, to me, was that's what makes the ending of that. They come together,
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
that God was really there in a new way for
Job. So you're saying that it's good to ask, maybe I'm reading this into it, it's good to ask why, but to not to settle for an answer. I mean, not to settle for a certain answer,
yeah,
or
not why, but we never really get the answer to why bad things happen to good people. But why is this happening? Sometimes gets people moving to make changes in systems and methods,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
but not to internalize it and make it it's happening because I've done something. Because the personal, I guess the why for me is the corporate why.
Yeah.
And the personal why isn't really the
mm-hmm.
question.
Mm-hmm.
But what's more important is when we go into ourselves, is to find that other strength is there
mm-hmm.
and around us. I think the friends might have been better if Joe
hadn't said it. Yeah, but that was kind of the thing that I was thinking then too, is but then how do we talk about this with each other? Because I think that's important too. You just can't take it inside yourself and there's time for that, but that's not enough for me. I need to talk to people about it. And I need to, like Mary is saying, I need to relate it to bigger structures too. And you kind of implied that too, that it's important to ask that why, because of the kind of changes that need to be made. Just a kind of a corporate suffering, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd just say it was just only one thing, but that,
What, does somebody have a watch? It must be about time to quit. Yeah, it's about time to quit. Well, I think Job is a book that's supposed to raise more questions than suggest answers. I hope this session has done the same.
One question. Did you have any thoughts about the Job of Advent?
Yeah, I was just going to read something about it. Right. It was really nice listening to people and the tapes and sort of learning about it for me. I sort of knew this. I mean, to know the structure of Job is one thing, but to actually enter into it is another thing, and I feel like I'm about that far into it. Maybe that far. But I had to try to tie it to present day, so I said that partly just because of that. But I once again, I lift up the theme that Dan said the other night, is that perhaps Advent, and I think of Lent in that term, in that sense too, is the time to enter into the hurt that we all have to feel. I believe, even Job, underneath his blamelessness and his righteousness and his correctness in praying for everybody, had to have a hurting spot inside. And maybe that's what the story is much about as anything, is getting to that spot in Job
to deal with that, because there's a God to be encountered there too. And I just thought of it in terms of Advent, that that's kind of the invitation to know that part of ourselves and meet that God before we celebrate the God who is born and lives and creates and redeems and gives us joy in our being together. And then also, I was reading here a little thing that reminded me very much of something that we read during this time of the year, during Advent. And so it's something that one of these counselors says. You know, they say some pretty good things. God gives rain upon the earth and sends water upon the fields. God sets up on high the lowly, and those who mourn God exalts to safety. God frustrates the plans of the cunning so that their hands achieve no success. God catches the wise in their own ruses, and the designs of the crafty are routed. They meet with darkness in the daytime, and at noonday they grope as though it were night. But the poor from the edge of the sword and from the hand of the mighty, God saves. Thus the unfortunate have hope, and iniquity closes the mouth. Happy is the one whom God reproves. The Almighty's chastening do not reject. It sounded significantly to me like very much like the Magnificat, some of those parts in there. And just kind of made that connection in the wisdom of Eliphaz on his way to the restaurant at the end of the universe.